We often see the human figure standing with the signs of the houses of the zodiac placed from the head to the feet, and there doesn't seem to be any rationale behind it in the vertical representation. If the human figure is put inside the wheel, then the relation between Pisces and Aries becomes apparent. Now, if we go around from here, Aries represents the unfinited spiritual energy which appears in the human being as nervous energy, and that is resident in the head, in the individual. If it remains unfinite, it cannot work, it cannot do anything whatever, and therefore it must circumscribe itself, it must come in, turn and work and continue to work before it is allowed out. And this entrance, rotation and work preceding release is symbolized in the Taurian glyph, which then governs the neck. It was customary to wear a rope round the neck and keep it fairly tight, like a tight collar, so that if you were about to speak, you would be made conscious of the movement of the larynx to help inhibit. You may have noticed that some blue gentlemen, extreme conservatives, take the knot from the tie and move it slightly to the left of the larynx so that it's not exactly equilibrated. And that is to remind them that the sinister side, in heraldic terms, the dark side of the shield, means secrets of power must be kept. So the rope around the neck, the little tie on the barrister's tie, is symbolizing Taurus. It means the ability not to let out what is known, because if you let it out prematurely, that is, prior to its maturation, it cannot work and develop as a seed inside you. When a stimulus comes to the ear or to any part of the body, energy is added. The stimulus is energy. The energy goes inside. If that energy takes a short path onto the vocal apparatus and comes out in words, you have lost the energy. If you can persuade the energy to circulate and send down an inhibiting message so that the breathing mechanism doesn't start the operation of speech and rotate the energy, then the energy becomes your own, which means that every stimulus that comes to you is providing you with energy, providing you don't let it out. Every individual, every finite being is trying to knock every other finite being off center until they realize what they really ought to be doing, namely inhibiting energy so that it can create a seed of a new body out of the material body. You know, St. Paul says first a physical body, then a spiritual body. We have to have a physical body. There's a symbol of Saturn, which means compression, contraction. And that physical body is a drift center for matter, which is a force inertia, which establishes a constant center for receiving stimuli. When the stimuli come to that body, they add energy to it. If the body can rotate the energies, it grows substantially within itself another body of a different order. If it lets the energy go out, it cannot grow. But if it contains the energy, this is the meaning of the religious continence, containingness, if it can contain it in its finite self, that it is contained and that it is finite causes it to change its frequency. It steps it up so that the quality of the awareness of that being is increased. If when somebody says something to you, an insult or something, you bounce immediately back with a response. You haven't really understood what that person was doing. But if you can retain the energy of the stimulus, which tends to come out as reaction, and turn that back upon itself, it changes its frequency. And then you become aware of what the person was trying to do, which you couldn't have known if you'd have reacted immediately. And the ideal is to stop reaction for any stimulus, whatever, until you have the power to be completely non-expressive in the presence of a stimulus. When you are completely able to inhibit, that fact is evidence that you have created another vehicle, another level of frequency within yourself. And this allows you to vibrate in tune with the field of the Absolute. We use the letter Aleph, the Hebrew letter, or the Greek letter Alpha, which is Taurus, to symbolize this kind of vibration which has become conscious for an individual at its highest level, conscious of the horns or inherent duality of the Absolute. The duality of the Absolute is that it has a power aspect and a substantial formal aspect. Every being, whatever, can be considered as power and as form of a substance. So that we shift a reference frame. The Absolute Reality has a power aspect and a formal substantial aspect. Insofar as it produces changes, we posit it as form. Insofar as it occupies space and produces tangibles, it is substance. Insofar as it is recognizable, it is form. But these are merely aspects of the unrepresented Absolute. So in Taurus we find it is said to control the neck and the trapezius muscle, which fastens to the back of the skull and goes down here. And when a person has a belief that they are being imposed upon at all by an external stimulus, and they are not allowed to speak out without controlling the energy in some measure, then the energy circulates and goes into this muscle, the trapezius. Now, trapezius is Torah, and pies, I'll put it here, this is pies, there's the Greek version of it. This means squeeze, and this means law. The law squeeze muscle, it means. The Torah pisius means that muscle that catches it when the law is imposed on you from outside. So fibrositis of the trapezius always arises when somebody is being put on, and unconsciously the energy is leaking the trapezius and it contracts and they hold the neck like that. Now you notice the spontaneous reaction of the champion stiff-necked people of the world. My people is a stiff-necked people. If they don't like it, they contract the trapezius and unconsciously throw off the burden. This is the cause of Guinness shrugging. It's the automatic leakage into the trapezius when they don't wish to accept the burden. Now, if you do accept the burden, but unconsciously and not deliberately, it contracts and becomes very stiff. It can become like, feels like steel sometimes. And no amount of massaging externally will remove it until that person becomes aware that they are really responding to a mental burden situation which is allowing leakage of energy into this muscle group. Now, every muscle group in the body has certain connections with ideational processes in the head. So particular disorders appear throughout the body in different ways according to the type of idea that is being stimulated by the situation. So the Taurian position is to remind us that we have to learn how to inhibit, and particularly to inhibit the tongue. And remember that if we were to represent a human being, there's the... Here is the Hebrew letter R. If we were to write it in English, we'd recognize it. We just turn it around that way. This represents, as you can see from this diagram, the human tongue. Resh means ruling power. And it goes down and right down to the bottom and then wiggles about and goes out. These wiggles are not quite anatomically correct. Are you good enough? Now, all of this is called the serpent in all the great religious systems. This is the worm that dies not. It is the vortical center of appetite, which has evolved for itself an articulator of its desires. So, all down here, I think we'll put the diaphragm in, if I know where we are. Everything below the diaphragm is unconscious appetite, and when it comes above the diaphragm, it becomes polarized as liking and disliking. And when the same energy, which is going on like the peristalsis down here, a ripple appears up here and comes on the tongue and speaks out of the belly of the whale, speaks Jonah. Now this is the articulator or little jointer. He's the fellow that tells you what is required down there. But up here is another world. Remember, the skull is hard and therefore under the dominion of Saturn, and the brain is very soft and therefore under the dominion of Jupiter. This is God the Father and this is the devil. This is the hard skull containing God the Father, and God the Father is sending messages down the spine trying to choke this serpent. If we cut certain nerves here on certain lower animals so that no message from here gets down here, all this thing goes on eating, and it will eat until the stomach actually bursts. So we know from that fact that there's an inhibiting message being sent down here, so that when it's at a certain degree of tension to fullness, it sends another message up: don't open the mouth anymore. So we see that, in fact, a human being is two systems. An appetite system there, which has learned to articulate what it wants. It's a cunning serpent. You may notice that in some people's tongues there is a sort of groovy depression in the center. In fact, part of bel canto technique is to acquire a groove in the back of the tongue. And some people have a very thick tongue like this, with no grooving. Now, those people with a thick, formless tongue, like a blob in the bottom of the mouth, are generally not good at articulation. And the others with a very mobile tongue are giving evidence of the nervous knitting to the tongue. The messages from the serpent below are reaching a high degree of conscious expression. All this department is the appetite, and it has climbed up in here to express itself, and it has invaded territory it doesn't really belong to. It all below the diaphragm is unconscious. Down there there are terrible urges, undetermined. They get through the diaphragm and climb up and become emotions: I like it and I don't like it. And if they climb higher still, they become words on the tongue. Meanwhile, another force with the star of the macrocosmic logos shining into it and another star, the five-pointed star, shining through the five senses, are at war with the serpent. This serpent is an unconscious drive. He doesn't know anything other than that which he actually hits at the moment. The message is from outside, from the five senses. Come in here and record the formal situation that was present when the appetite centers were indulging themselves in certain ways. And it gives a list in here of all formal situations in which pleasure and pain have been experienced. And it grows in its fullness of the record up here by the pain specifically. The pleasure one causing a return of energy down to the naughty old worm. So here we have the five sense messages. What you see, there's a drawing pin, you sit on a drawing pin. You have a visual image of a drawing pin and a sensation down below. And this sensation is clamming up here and becoming pain. That is recording up here and fusing with the visual image of the drawing pin, saying that such and such a shape or form means so much pain. So there's an inhibiting factor from the five senses fighting back onto the worm. But that old worm, that intestinal worm, is driving the whole organism continuously into experience, and thereby adding up the five sense data, which will inhibit the serpent driving into the situation. So it breeds dialectically out of itself, out of its own empirical experience, a formal record that makes it progressively more cautious, until in the end it can defeat itself and sit down and high frequency that continuously goes through the whole organism. But the worm cannot be conscious of that macrocosmic influx until it has been inhibited by the five sense structure. The five sense structure must inhibit the mighty serpentine desires and make them so cautious. As it says in the Tao Te Ching, if I had the great chopper, I would hesitate to use it. He must become so cautious, so balanced, that he becomes very, very sensitive. He's got his five-pointed experience filed on the brain. And when he's balanced it and dare not move, he goes into a negative condition. And either he dies, or he decides to become super cautious and to learn principles of action which are universal instead of general. The five-pointed star gives you only the general rule. And the general isn't good enough. You want a universal rule. And David Hume proves that the general is only the particular used over a series of incidents. The general is the particular used over a series. And it will not do for all situations. So he has to stand still, and in that standing still he becomes aware that the whole organism is already penetrated throughout its whole being by that symbolized by the six-pointed star. You remember that that was made of two triangles, one symbolizing fire and the other water, one symbolizing energy and the other substance. The fire one means energy and the water one means substance. There are two aspects of one reality which cannot be known as it is. It can only be known formally by the meaning of the word known. Remember KN, closure, negation, zone, and the overlapping of energies. To know a thing is to deal with a finite aspect. So we want something beyond knowing. This six-pointed star, this double interlaced triangle, tells us the top aspects of reality that we can consider before we transcend consideration. Consideration means with they see there the stars, the astral processes that are suffusing the whole body. You can call this cosmic radiation if you like at its very, very grossest level. But the cosmic radiation measured by scientists today is not that. It is far grosser than the stuff we're talking about. This is a very, very fine energy travelling through the whole organism. If the appetite centre, the serpent, which has to be lifted up on the cross, like Moses lifted it up, towed, by the application of the five sense general law, until it is completely negated, so that the whole egoic drive of the serpent is brought to a standstill. In that standstill is the possibility, because it is like death, of a sprouting of a new consciousness. Standstill is the name of one of the most important Chinese ideographs, where the whole being has been negated so that its individual consciousness is convinced that it is powerless, and it becomes profoundly depressed as an individual. It is the state of the corruption that the alchemists talk about, that precedes the awareness in the falling into death in despair that there is something behind all this, a very fine energy going through it. Then, as we become aware of that energy going through it, we let go of the egotistical stress, we let go of the empirical self built by the five senses. The egoic self is built by the five senses, and we discover another thing, the meaning of the word self, non-egoic. It's a good thing to use the Latin ego for it, because the Romans, being gross materialists, put into their word for I the gamma, the hard G, which symbolizes gross materiality. So although the E letter signifies spirit, this means gross establishment. And this means following the G, coming to nothing. So already to call themselves ego is to say I come to nothing through an overstress of gross material. There are other words for it. The English word I is diphthong, I, in R and E, and signifies energy and a point of application. The German for I, ich, the dot is first, and this is a compound KH, and means effort and overcoming. So a German feels he must overcome. An Englishman feels that he is applying energy to a particular. A Frenchman has his difficulty at the beginning. This is his dot, and it becomes his you. He is applying energy at the beginning, and it becomes feeling. This is his attempt at rationality, and this is his emotionalism. An Italian says io. There's his nothing, and there's his little I in the middle of it. Each nation conveys in the word he uses to signify himself his attitude towards being. There is another word, we take the Sanskrit aham, which says that the primary energy spiritualized itself, gave forth another energy which then substantialized itself. So we see the concept of aham in Sanskrit means an energy gathering itself together and giving forth another energy that implies two bodies, substantializing itself. Each nation has a word, and that word is the symbol of its own attitude towards the self. Now, the self, with a capital S, remember S is originally a serpent. So if we write S-E-L, which means soul, and the F on the end means the spiritual issue of the soul. The soul is Saturn, the contraction, and the F is coming out of it. It's the evolving spirit of egotism. If we close the serpent, we get the initial medial S of the Greeks. When we begin, we have to finite ourselves. When we're in the middle, we're still finited. And when we come to the end of a word, we are free when we come to the end of the process. We'll keep this fellow down here now.
Okay.
Well, we're coming back to consider the meaning of the macrocosmic influx to the man. He doesn't know it exists, but just like radio waves in this room now and going right through our bodies without our consciousness as individuals, so this absolute force, not solar, not side zero, an absolute force, is coming through the organism continuously. And it is that force that is organizing the body and keeping the body healthy. If that force and that force alone were allowed to operate, with no egoic interference, it would be in perfect health and it would be a body of light. It would not be a gross material body at all. And that is the meaning of the transmutation of the base metal, Saturn, lead, into the gold of the solar will. We have to turn corruption, covetousness, individuated egotistic gram into radiating will prepared to give like the sun gives light. That is the transmutation of lead into gold. And that has to be done in the human being, because in no other being can it be done. Only the human being can do it. This energy must be realized, made real in the body. It is there, but it is not real until we can differentiate it and link the differentiated together. The re is the king, and the al is the god. God is my king is the meaning of the word real. Differentiation, link. To differentiate, to analyze, to break into bits, and then to synthesize what has been broken together. That is religion. The old serpent that ties himself up. Religion. This is the real meaning of the back tying, the lig ligaturing. But the word real implies that you have differentiated yourself consciously and have synthesized the differentiated elements. And only then are you real. So, although this is running through us all, it isn't real for us until we have differentiated all our parts so that they harmoniously vibrate with that fundamental. That is there all the time. It is that which gives the message to say, let's form some teeth for baby before it's born, so that when it comes out it will be able to bite a bit and let mama know that she hasn't lived in vain. And behind it, it says, let's make some more teeth so that when we finish with mother, we'll be able to bite into something more fiercely. These things are prepared before they're actually used by the individual, by this force symbolized by the logos. If we allowed it to operate without any interference whatever, it would put us all into order. This is what is behind a movement like Sabud or something like that. It's the attempt to allow this to speak. And if you could allow it to speak properly, then everything would become organically correct. We are in process of evolving, and there is interference from generalities, apperception masses from the five senses, which have been created by appetite, by egotistical self-expression, crashing into situations, suffering terrible pains and recording the pains up here as situations to keep out of. As we are keeping out of the situation, we are restraining ourselves, becoming progressively more and more saturnine. And as we are becoming more and more saturnine, we are becoming less and less and less capable of responding to this. But as we are becoming more saturnine, we are also increasing the pressures inside ourselves. These pressures can be released only by incandescence. This may be partial and unprepared for, and we call it insanity. It may be total and prepared for by a series of exercises, and it isn't insanity at all. It is insanity, health within. the difference between in as a negative and in as an internal fact. So we have to drive ourselves through our painful experiences to the point where our egotism becomes full. We become full egotists instead of wishy-washy, Laodicean, Laodicean egotism. It must be made conscious, and we can only do it by driving ourselves into painful situations and to discover that this worm down here doesn't want a painful situation at all. He just wants a record up there of painful situations to dodge so that he can go in and get his clever tongue around what he wants and bring it down here again. This is the old serpent, and it is the precipitate of an eternal energy. That energy is the source in which the soul of man is rooted. Alchemically, it is generated between Mars and Venus. And we said before that these two triangles symbolize energy and water, energy and substance, fire and water. Mars symbolizes energy, but now individuated, and Venus the individuated passivity of the substance of the being. And in between those two, between the substantial and the desire energies, the soul is born. Which means that when an egg is fertilized and begins to develop, it goes through certain stages. And at a certain stage, when the fluids of the body are prepared, a nervous impulse comes down. That is the fire. And at that point, and not before, where the nervous energy flows down for the first time into that organism and penetrates the fluid aspect of it, at that moment the soul is conceived. Not the form, which is going to impart it to it later. The soul is born at that point. We would call it the quickening of the child, the mother. Suddenly, instead of being a mere vegetative structure, deriving energies from outside, from its mother, it suddenly becomes a centre in its own right. Everything has been developed by the orders of the absolute Logos and brought to a stage where the chemistry of the fluid aspects of the body and the electronic and other forces in the nervous system are perfectly balanced, and there's a sudden discharge of energy from the nervous system through the fluids in the body, which is exactly analogous to the incandescence produced by the contraction of egotism. So at that moment, a light flashes through the whole organism and it becomes a soul. And from that moment, it will start moving about, stretching its arms, closing its whatever it is, or opening it if it's shut, and so on. And from that moment, it is a soul in its own right. And therefore, it is very important what a woman is doing during the period prior to that, because her emotion creates chemical situations in her body, and through her body, in her blood, with which she's supplying the chemistry to the child's chemical predisposition is established. So that when the flash comes, the temperament, the balance, is determined in the quickening. So that really the foundation of the character of that child is already set by the emotional state of the mother. So obviously the father, knowing such facts, would put a certain kind of energy into the mother, physically and mentally and so on, to keep her balance so that the child's chemistry will be balanced at that moment. The child would then be a product of the father's intent, his reason balancing, and the mother's will to produce this thing. The father is the nervous energy in him, and the mother is the fluid aspect, and the two together produce the child, which then becomes a soul. Now after another period of development of a few months, it is extruded, and at the moment of extrusion it breathes air for the first time, and the shock of the air upon it acts like the shock of the nervous energy did internally, and lifts it into another phase of being. It then becomes an intellectual being. Before it was a soulish being. And the essence of the soulish life is sentiency, simply feeling. But when the air is inbreathed, it suddenly becomes an intellectual being. It judges. And remember, the first shock of that is a pain. And we've said there is no thought without a pain. So when that air rushes down there and those lungs are inflated, certain processes occur and the appetite, which was previously fed through the navel there, suddenly becomes aware that something has happened in here, and the accent of consciousness is shifted momentarily over there for the shock. And at that moment a pain is experienced and the energy flies into the head and records itself there. So that the whole constellation of forces on the child, again, is a determinant. It is now an intellectual soul. If we consider the form in the soul, from the macrocosmic logos, it is called the spirit of the soul. Absolute. If we consider the form from the five senses, as they were stimulated at the first impact of air, that is called the spirit of the soul individual. Some people who cannot, I'm talking about theologians, cannot understand what is the meaning of a twofold and threefold division in the Bible. There's a simple one, soul and body, and there's another one, spirit, soul and body. And the theologians argue quite a lot about it. The real meaning is that the soul and the body are in opposition as energy to substance. But the form of the soul, the stimulus that it receives, which leaves formal traces in it, is called the spirit of the soul, the formal content of it. And that is either from the five senses building up a pseudo-self, the egoic self, or the true self of the absolute coming through it. So if then you identify with all the empirical data through your five senses, then you are an individual of the lower egoic level. But if you identify with the absolute logos, then you are a super individual. That is, you are beyond that egoic consciousness, but nevertheless you have a self that is a salt. Because you are a compressed being, a saturnine compress, which has produced a flash. Flesh and flash are etymologically the same word. If there were no flash of nervous energy into the fluids in that body, it could not become flesh. It would corrupt in utero, and that would be the end of it. That flash must come. We said before, there is only the one process of generation of a star, a sun, a planet, or anything else. So now, in the diaphragm, we have a membrane stretched across the body, specially grown as a product of two forces, one pressing down and one pressing up. The serpent is trying to get up to dominate the situation. So in this diaphragm, through this thragma, it says that above there is reason. This is diaphragma. And thragma is pida, reason. And the ga is the gross material fact, and the is the closure of that substance, substantial aspect, gross aspect, ga. Pira is the fire of the serpent, now rationalized. So this is exactly the same as the firmament, or the lower firmament, in Genesis 1. Everything below that is hell. It is literally hell. That is to say, if a human being were made conscious of the chemical processes of digestion and so on, to him it would be a hellish torment, unbearable. You know that as long as you are functioning properly, you are unaware of a process going on in the stomach or in the duodenum or in somewhere else. And if you become aware of it, something has gone wrong. Everything below the diaphragm is hell. It is specially held in by the forces of this absolute logos who have compressed this serpent, which was the original will to dominate the absolute, and had in it an inherent dialectical self-contradiction. that it wanted to be finite, and then it wanted to eat the infinite, which is illogical. It has appetite, and the appetite can grow, it can extend, but because it is finite, no matter how long it grows, it can never eat infinity. So it is doomed, no matter how much it may extend its dominion, dome eye on the wicked serpent. There is always something beyond it, and this something beyond is the source of its eternal dissatisfaction. So no matter how big it may extend, its worm dies not. It is an eternal appetite. And because it is inherently a contradiction to try to defeat infinity and eat it, there is, because of its finite nature, a necessary finite radius, there's the centre of it, of its aggression against the infinite. This finite radius is the diaphragm in the individual human being. So he bangs up against there, and this force meets him equal and opposite on the other side. On that point comes the solar plexus. So he bangs up against there, and this force meets him equal and opposite on the other side. On that point comes the solar plexus. And there, just as in the child developing in utero, there had to be a flash. So here, at this point, there is a special kind of flash. A new possibility where the old hellish serpent locked up below the diaphragm, at this point, can strike a light, a special kind of light. You will notice that if ever you feel a sense of loss and you place your consciousness there, you will feel the depression in the solar plexus. You'll become aware that all losses are registered there. It is where the serpent's head is lifted. Now you know what a serpent looks like, a cobra, and hissing especially. That is exactly like the stomach swelling. There's the food tube coming down, and as soon as it breaks through the diaphragm, it swells out like this. You see? There's your cobra head. And it is trying to force itself up. It is being met. And it cannot get through. So it pushes its tongue up. It extends and says, I must speak. I must voice myself in the enemy territory where intelligence absolute is spreading. He said, but I must secure for myself a voice. And so the voice is an outgrowth of the vice. And the only difference is the O. Everything that is devilish down here below the diaphragm, as it becomes aware of this dome, which is this O, conceives out of vice the necessity for voice. And climbs up and articulates and says what he wants. And while it's busy saying, I want, this inexorable absolute is coming down and saying, I'm washing you, free from your wants. Because dialectically you have cut yourself from this wisdom and committed yourself to learn only through pain. So here's your pain record, looking through the eyes to see if that's another drawing pin, or another gentleman, or another lady, or whatever it was that caused the pain. And then this is crying and saying, another one of those horrible things, don't go. We've said before that this serpent down here is either positive or asleep. It never says no, it only says yes, or snores. Down there is the pure positive of appetite. And here is that same thing lifted above the dome of the diaphragm and rationalized as pleasure and pain. The Greek word phren, from which we derive schizophrenia and so on, means mind, but to the Greeks it meant the lungs and all the zone of the diaphragm and above it. So the phren is this part of the judgment mechanism which has to do with pleasure-pain, whereas the nous, the Greeks placed in the head, deriving information from the absolute, as opposed to the five senses. So there's the noose, or Yorkshire nuts. And here is the frame down here where one becomes frenzied or tortured by likings and dislikings. And here is the dome or firmament over the hell. Now we said we'd talk about the states of this appetite. We call it maw, M-A-W. M1 means more in its first state, M2 more in its second, M3 more in its third. More in its first state is more with nothing to eat. And it is in a state of profound melancholy. You might have seen some alchemical references to this, or even drawings of a lady sitting in the dark with her head between her knees and her arms around her shins, looking very miserable. There's nobody there to eat. This is called M1. It is represented as a woman, because woman represents the volitional side of man, as the male represents the ideational side of the human. So as Adam was created male and female, so in Adam there are two aspects, volitional, appetite, that's the female aspect, and ideational, formal content, the male aspect. And therefore, when we come to consider all things to do with the feelings and the appetites, we have to say it belongs to M. And we translate M as Mary. So we say this is Mary 1, or Mary 2, or Mary 3, or shortly M1. Now, M1 is when there is nobody about. So you can guarantee that unless you've got a keyhole, you will never experience it. If ever you find an M, it could occur in a man. Remember, we are hermaphrodites. And therefore, a man could become willful and sulk if he wanted to, as well as a woman. And if he did so, it would be the woman in him that was doing it. If he were in a room on his own and didn't know that we were watching him through the keyhole, and he sat down in complete despair, we'd say that is genuine M1. But if he heard us for a moment flickering our eyelashes at the keyhole and thought he was being watched, immediately he could no longer be M1. He would convert into M2. M2 is symbolized by Mary Magdalena. Mary Magdalena was a prostitute, or fantastic lady. She sold fantasy. When the appetite, which previously had nothing to eat, there was nothing in the environment, suddenly sees food approaching, usually on two legs, it suddenly becomes fantastic. So if it knew that we were watching through the keyhole, it would alter its behavior. From being horribly ugly in its misery, it would suddenly become gracefully miserable. This actually happens, suddenly a change of poles. This is why we say that consciousness is a catalyst, because a person that's in profound dejection, I once set a little experiment for a fellow I know, who didn't believe the M123 relation to be true, and he said that he would like to test it empirically. So I told him that if ever he'd seen his girl miserable, she was M2ing, she wasn't M1. And he must devise an occasion when he could spy on her, definitely without her knowledge, while she was being in despair. So he waited about 8 years, and eventually he caught her. And to his amazement, she was sitting there with her legs wide open.
She was
on. And he thought, that's it. You see, she was sitting with legs akimbo, scowling away. And then he remembered that I'd said that if she became aware of the slightest sound that might suggest she was being overlooked, that there'd be a change of posture. So he just went, a little cough. And at that moment, she apparently didn't move. But suddenly she wasn't ugly anymore. And the ankle came out, the foot out. She was gracefully thrown. That was M2. You see, as soon as the maw knows there's a possible dinner, and it's got to be lured to it, you know, there's a kind of spider that eats its husband, then it becomes very, very graceful. So that the dinner will go out and say, my dear, you're looking terribly sad, and pat it on the head and lose a hand. That is the stage called M2. Now, that is Mary Magdalena. He's the fantastic lady that Christ converts from her naughtiness. And only Christ can. The rest of us are trying. We must get this Christ, absolute logos, consciousness, before we can convert M2 into M3. Now, M3 is the mother of Mary. That is, the three is a triangle. The equilibrated more, the perfectly balanced appetite. In the first state, the more is one, and there's nothing to eat. So it divides itself, two means duality. And it divides itself into dinner and eater. Remember the Samson riddle we said was so very important. Out of the eater came forth meat. The eater is the appetite, the primary appetite, the universal wolf. And it simply rolls itself into a ball to make itself a dinner. And the part that's been rolled into a ball becomes egotistic. And says, I'm not your dinner, and runs off. And the part that is rolling it into a ball says, but I rolled you up. And a metaphysical argument ensues, it's not finished yet, as to which side of the debate is correct. The moment that the absolute energy, which is more, it has this quality of being appetite, divides itself, then there is a relation of more powerful, less powerful. And the more powerful then proceeds to eat the less powerful and define it as dinner. And the less powerful rushes off, defining itself as a believer in freedom. The division then causes a terrific chase. You remember the Hindu concept of God sitting on his own and suddenly becoming afraid and said, I'm alone. So he said, I will make for myself a woman. So he rolled up a woman. And then he got hold of the woman and said, we will now make a universe. And she slapped him and said, you can't do that to me, I'm you, and ran away. And he pursued her and she changed herself into a tigress. So he changed himself into a tiger, and out of that came all the striped pussycats. And he then changed himself into a deer, and so on. This is the metamorphosis of will into all the forms. You get it in magical rituals, where one magician pretends he's a butterfly, and another one pretends he's a bird and eats him. As soon as he eats him, this one says, aha, I changed myself into Bacillus Crowley, now eat me. And then a battle goes on inside, you see. He becomes a bacterium and he becomes a bacteriophage, and they go on chasing you down the nights and down the days in this manner until eventually the sum total energies of the chase overheat the pair of them and they incandesce. They suddenly realize it is self chasing self, and at that moment it becomes M3, the perfectly equilibrated appetite that is aware that it was chasing itself, and there's no sense in running away from oneself. And if one can eat oneself without resistance, it is possible to enjoy a meal. And this process of self-eating instead of trying to eat someone else is what we mean by continence. To take the energies that come in and eat them. And not to try to get hold of the source, the imagined source of them, but simply to eat what you've got in yourself. To make no attempt to make incursions into other people's territory, but if anything comes into you, eat it and contain it. And this is the process that has to be learned, the process of self-eating. This is how Samson, the son of the seed, grows into the powerful macrocosmic being, pulls down the temple, the time play, and thus attains his absolute majority. So down here below the diaphragm is this serpent, where there's nothing to eat. It's M1, it's very miserable. When you set before it special optics, which it's got here, for gazing at dinner, then it starts going nice little gestures and little chuckles come out from here, limp, limp, and so on. And it begins to send messages up, and they go out to the arms and bring it to. All this fantastical display is part of M2. When it finally reaches flashpoint in the fight between eating and being eaten, it converts into the enlightened will that knows that it has always been an appetite, that there is nothing other than this appetite, which is absolute energy, that energy created for itself by rolling up energy into a ball, its special one meat ball. And in the process of doing so, of gaining this enlightenment, there's no more chase. But when an individual gains that level of no more chase, he has not saved all the other individuals. So there was still gone coming to him and trying to capture him and eat him up. And as they're coming and trying to eat him up, they're stimulating him. And their attentions are more food. And he doesn't want more food. And the less he wants, the more he'll get. It's a dialectical rule. If he seeks to preserve his petty little five-sense ego, he will lose it. But if he's prepared to lose it, he will gain this sixfold, absolute one. So when we consider the whole process, as you gain in integration and continence, so you are ceasing to be a reaction system for other people. Now, it is a psychological law and a physical law that there can be no action without a reaction. And if you do not get a reaction on your own level, you will starve, literally. So if an egoic individual of the five sense order insults you and you don't respond, he begins to die from that moment. So to preserve his life, he will try to break down your resistance. If he fails completely, he will run away and not bother you again, because he will lose his life. Unto him that hath, unto him shall be given. To him that hath not this, even that which he hath, that will be taken away. Because he cannot help at that level of the five-point man. It's trying to stimulate other beings. And that energy of stimulus that he uses, he has lost unless he can produce a reaction back from that being. So you'll notice that if ever you've tried to insult anybody and they've immediately been tremendously upset and flashed back at you, a warm glow of delight has begun in the epitometic zone below me. That got him. That got under the skin. Now, that glow is nothing but the feedback, his reaction coming into your organ and feeling it. On the other hand, if he just looks at you and he goes out of focus and carries on reading, there's a sensation in the solar plexus of dreadful loss, misfire. You see? And you've paid energy out and none has come back. And he's grown and you've diminished. Like John the Baptist says, I must decrease and he must increase. This is like John the Baptist, and this is he who must increase. So in the whole process, we have an indication of what we've got to do. In every situation, every day, some individual will try to get underneath our skin. If we allow a reaction out, we diminish and they are fed. If we manage to inhibit it, they will diminish and we will be fed by this, and they will go away and gather their forces together for another try. If after a number of tries they have failed consistently with you, they will go away completely, and in the process they will try to annoy somebody else, because if they fail to annoy anybody whatever, they will perish utterly. As the hare said. So let's think about the practical application now. Tie the rope around your neck. Gentlemen wear a tie. The origin of the necktie of a man is just as a mnemonic device. Something to remind us by a little movement here that we're about to say something. We're about to react. Civilized men tend to react by saying something. Uncivilized man by doing something. As we're supposed to be civilizing, we wear a necktie to remind us not to react. So if we wear it fairly tight, I know it's not down, it's a bit teddy boys, but if we wear it tight like an early priest used to do with his rope around his neck, as soon as the larynx moves, it has to adjust itself and lift a little bit to put the ring cartilage at the base of the tongue on top of it. As soon as it moves, then let that movement be a reminder, shut up. We've just gained some energy. And in that moment, the awareness that you've gained energy will help you to shut up. Whereas if you thought that you were shutting up for nothing, or that the other fellow was gaining a point if you shut up, you will speak. So the important thing is to realize that if you speak, he will gain. And if you can shut up, you'll gain. And in this process, you're told in the Bible, if you do this, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Because his brain will go very, very quickly, round and round and round, it gets hot, straight away. Because it's looking for something to say, to compensate for the last misfire. We're not supposed to heap coals of fire on people's head as a deliberate policy. To do that would be to lose. Never mind the ethics of it. If we thought, well, I'll heap coals of fire on that bloke's head, we'd first have to expend energy on him to provoke him to provoke us. And it might misfire. So any deliberate attempt to put coals of fire on his head must fail. So we mustn't do that. Not because of any ethics, but because it's bad mechanics. Ultimately, every ethical proposition is a mechanical proposition. Every moral postulate is just an efficiency postulate. So we have to remind ourselves of this all the time. Energy coming in through the eyes, a little wiggle of a pelvis, whether with or without skin on it, whatever it is. When it goes in, it starts a process in here and tends to produce something here. Catch it, inhibit it. Save it and know that it is yours if you don't let it out. And know that until you have practiced a lot, until you've engrammed on your substance, that it is a real loss if you let it out, and a gain in substantiality and real being and eternal substantiality, you're building immortality. When you've recited that often enough, it will be easy for you to inhibit that response. And recited it often enough, you will respond, and every time you do, you'll feel bad because you know that you've lost energy. Certainly in this room we cannot claim ignorance. In little spirals and concentrated and produce a plurality of beings in order that each being shall be driven down to hell. Its pressures increase so that it can and comes back a reciprocal centre of the absolute. Now the whole process is perfectly simple. From the energy point of view, we are finite systems. We want to increase power, increase consciousness. Every time a stimulus comes from another being or from a situation, if we see a beautiful landscape, it is energy feeding into us. It has associations and centers. If we lift our hands to the sky, like a little spinster might do to herself, and appreciate it internally, she groans. And if we go all artistic on it and say, well, a smashing sunset, we're losing some energy in the expression. So if we allow it to come into us and don't let it out, we are growing. And this is selfishness of the highest order, as opposed to selfishness of the lower order that's always letting rubbish out onto other beings. We want the higher selfishness, this selfishness of the six-pointed selfishness as opposed to five-pointed. And let's recap this state of the maw. When the appetite, that is the will in a man or a woman, has nothing to eat, nobody to batten on, nobody to annoy, nobody to chew, and so on, it is profoundly miserable and also tremendously ugly. Because really the appetite without nothing to eat is very, very ugly. Because he's got no reason to be otherwise. Not a moral statement. It is ugly because it is turbulent in a staccato manner. It is impulsive and grabbing at its potentials in all directions. There's no real coordination. But the moment a potential meal appears on the horizon, its behavior immediately becomes rhythmically attractive to bring the din-din close to. And remember, we're talking about the human being in its dual polarized aspect, man, woman. Every man has a woman inside him, every woman has a man. The nervous system in a woman is a man. the belly system in a man is a woman. We've all got both. If we manage out of our disappointments and thwartings of our appetite in the Magdalena or fantastic state of our will, trying to attract the dinner, if we manage to suffer enough, we will create heat, friction, energy, and don't let it out, and it will crash to all the barriers and become an illuminating brain. And at that point, the appetite has converted itself. This is the great Om. This more now has gone right to the limit of being and written itself as an inflexibly self-conscious more magician or magician. Remember, the word magic is from the Moor. The primary appetite elevating itself more. Substantial appetite activity grossly established in a material body, intellectually formulated and applied consciously. Magic is simply the whole process of the development of the will. Is there any aspect of this that could do with clarification? Yes.
Which is the higher one, which you said, of course, is more developed. And that's the basic one, isn't it? Where you're just retaining the energy, actually, the which is sieve concerns aviation and everything, isn't it?
Yes, but remember, the sieve itself is the formal grid of the action. How can the which is a WH, an entity with Icha in it, a will to something, Ich, the Sanskrit Icha, is will, it's precipitation on points. The sieve is the formal grid of the absolute. How can the which, that is the being with the Ich, to manifest, go to see, that is the cosmic Mare, the Mary, in the sieve? The answer is block it with clay. That's the real witch. Clay is your gross material body. If you don't have a gross material body reference center to which you can constantly refer, then you are fantastic. The whole purpose of getting a physical body first is to get a persistent stimulus to which you can refer and integrate all your ideas so that your idea body grows out of your physical body as a continuously present stimulus. So that's putting the clay in the sieve. That's putting your gross material body inside the grid of form of the action. And sailing on the sea, Mare, the cosmic ocean, of experience.
One question I'd like to ask. The Sanskrit definition of alice appears to be more profound than all the others. Does that mean that Sanskrit was not a gentle language, but a priest language?
It was a priestly language, yes.
Seems to be far more profound than the others.
You can actually infer a nation's philosophy from the word they use for I and me. I will give you the whole of their subjective philosophy, and me, their objective philosophy. You see, there are two aspects, the observer and the observed. The absolute reality has aspects to a finite being. It has no aspects to itself. It is solid being, absolute substantial power. You cannot divorce the substantiality from the power aspect. So Sanskrit was a priestly language, and in it, therefore, the terms were very, very carefully considered. And remember, Christ says, out of the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaks. This worm banging up against here is creating, when it breaks through the diaphragm with its tongue, pleasures and pains, trying to get back. But every time it meets a situation and the external stimulus is painful, it goes back into the spinal nerves and climbs up and then sends a message down here to say something about it. So when this region is full, then this mouth will speak. Your emotion. This is the emotional place. Down here is the appetite, urge, volition, unconscious. When it breaks through the diaphragm, it has already become X motion, moving out E motion. And when it fills this zone, you notice that people who've got a lot to say take a deep breath when they say it. And they compress themselves down here because in this center one feels superior to the hellish aspect of the being. So if you ask a man to put his consciousness in the chest and say what he feels, all do it, just lift your chest and breathe in and just hold it a moment and feel how you feel. We'll all feel the same about this. If we're perfectly honest with ourselves, we feel fine. We'll feel as if we're capable. We'll feel dignified and decent and ideal. If we carry our weight on the ribs, to test that feeling, just let the ribs fall, relax, let your tummy stick out, pull your consciousness low down, and see what you feel like then. The ideality is gone. It's dropped. Test that by pulling the consciousness up, by lengthening the spine with the consciousness, running up the spine, right to the top of the head, and lift yourself up like that. And when you're up at the height, notice that you feel impersonal about it. Your ideality feeling isn't there, but there's a total awareness feeling over the head. And then deliberately bring it down to the space between the eyebrows and center it there, and you will immediately feel a peculiar kind of authority with a potential aggression in it. Can you feel it? Get used to those centers in your body. Because when you're not watching yourself, you tend to fall, literally. The consciousness drops down the body. The spinal posture goes. The ribs collapse. The tummy sticks out, and so on. The whole thing falls, and that is the meaning of the fall. Put your sky hook on. Pull it up. Gently, you know. Correct spinal posture is the key. There's no other posture in yoga, actually. In the classic, original yoga posture has only one rule. That's the rule. The spine must be correct. It's to do with the play of forces around the spine. If you allow the spine to be like this. You see, actually, the physical cord is out of line with the field. And it must be in line with the field. The moment you rise that line, you feel better. You are better. And your nervous energies are flowing, and that is the only rule in yoga asana. Namely, spinal posture must be correct and easy. Nothing else. If you cross your legs behind your ears, whatever you do, it will not produce spirituality. But if you can remember to keep the spine long and keep the consciousness up there, except for moments of command, then you will be super individual. And if you bring it down there because you want to say something meaningfully, you'll immediately feel the command and the authority coming through that center. The Arjuna here is an authority center. The great militaries always practice by that center because it gives power to give orders. And the great sages prefer this one because they don't want to give any orders. But if you can get here, you're doing very well, to center yourself before you become absolute, just center yourself as an authority in your own life. Get used to that and hang all the being. Remember, you're a hanged man. This is another aspect of the hanged man. And think that, really, when you stretch the spine, you are doing so. I hope my hair's sticking. When you stretch your spine in that way, you are doing so because an energy in you is anti-gravitational. I think that's it's a real statement. Stretch the spine is to open a door of an anti-gravitational force. Something in us that is not gravitational. That's a gravitational force. Think that there is something up there that has come to the earth and lifted something up out of the earth. A plant, an animal, a human being, and wants to lift that human being to a proper level. Turn a man into a human. Into his fullness, there. So that when you lift yourself smoothly and gently, no rigidity, you are actually using an energy that's coming from this six-pointed star down the spinal axis and and circulates around it, polarizes every part of it, and that alone, if you do nothing egotistically stupid against it, will organize and order the whole body without anything else. And if you allow that spinal posture to begin to sag, even at the gross mechanical level, the vertebrae are separate and they lean over, and you'll get discs floating out to right and left, for example, and you'll trap nerves and you'll decrease circulation, the organism will suffer mechanically. But not only that, you will suffer psychically, because remember that the soul has been put into a physical body so that you can build a spiritual body out of the physical. Your spiritual body is the form that you are building into the soul by means of the physical body. So first has to be a physical body, and then the processes in the physical body strike a light, and it becomes a soul. Soul being your soul will, soul understanding. And then it has to be elevated to the point where it becomes cosmically conscious, out of the actual matter of the body. The chemistry of a man who has become wise isn't the same as it was when he was ignorant. An Abyssinian priest spits on the face. Now, we might think he's rude, but a good priest has very good spit. Even ordinary people spit's quite good for tender eyes, you know. It's a wonderful thing. You put it on a cut, it's about the best thing you can get. So, it's a healing thing. It is not made of the salt of the things. So you see that the whole organism itself is produced by two forces. Let's have a little drawing, shall we? Can we come down this way? How about handling this? Yeah. I bet I've got a handle next week. If I have to.
But how about that? I'll ask a question before you quite leave. This process of retaining energy is a conscious process. One must have the information to be able to practice this.
Yeah.
There are people you meet who seem to have an unconscious ability to absorb insults. The people who one would say were good-natured, some people seem to be able to take this to a high level. Is this possible to get anything unconsciously?
Let's have a look at some of those people. There are some people who actually don't know when they're insulted. Aren't there? There are such people. You say something and it's over their head literally. That's one type. There's another kind, we would call them the Venus type. And although they have a vague idea that you're intending to be inimical, they happen to be fluid in the psyche. So that whatever you say, as it goes in, and becomes form, it's dissolved. It's lost in them, literally, to them. And immediately their own nature, their own inertia, not their own will, their inertia, reasserts itself. And to them it's a fresh start. They're the Venus type. They're generally fair. And a certain kind of translucence about the flesh. They look like true Venusians, you know. They look very, very nice, very, very placid. They're hard to insult, because whatever you say is form, and they are not formed beings. And whatever you put in them, an insult is always a form, you know. Whatever you put in them, they immediately dissolve it. Just if you've got a bit of salt, that's form, that's in it. Drop it in the water. And they look for it. Where is it? It's all over. And the water doesn't know anything about it. It's been distributed and equilibrated as if it had never been. So you come tomorrow and you apologize, and she doesn't know what for. Literally. Now, it won't do. It's not what we want. And it isn't the same thing as conscious willed continence. What we want is the ability consciously to get an insult, an injumped energy, and to bring it round, use it as a meditation energy on the nature of the significance of the insult and not let it out. That's the method. To take the insult and immediately universalize it. So the fellow says, you flat-footed. You see, and you immediately think, flat foot now. That's an insult. I suppose the foot shouldn't be flat. It should be arched. Why arched? Arches are very strong, aren't they? you can put terrific weight on an arch. And the arch of the foot is a good arch, very strong and very springy. It's very, very good, you see. In fact, without an arch in the foot, we don't walk very well. And use up all the energy of the insult to universalize the proposition, mechanical, geometrical, and so on. You have then grown, and they have worked for you. They don't know you, and they're not getting paid. They're secret slaves. It's part of what is called the tacit conspiracy. Yeah, I was going to bundle me up to you. Here is the earth as we know it. I want you now to imagine this is a diaphragm, and the diaphragm goes all the way around. So this is like the gross material of the body, and inside that there's a worm which continuously trying to force his way out through the earth, producing volcanic eruptions. Over here is an absolute sun, and down here another sun, the one that shines on our earth. There are innumerable other complications, but we'll keep it simple. This force is coming very, very gently straight through the whole lot. Light, absolute, is shining in this darkness. And that darkness is not comprehending the light. And it cannot from itself get out because it is covetous. It is egotistic. It is dragging in all the time to the center and trying to eat infinity. It is taking everything that falls to it and packing it. It is gravity, gravity. It is the zone of death. It is trying to kill everything and reduce everything that comes to it to food, and by turbulating inside to digest it and to drag in more. Now that is an initial will called the Saturnine impression to existence, and that will arose in the absolute. The absolute is the Father, and soul, the Son, and the Lute is the ghost or spirit. The absolute is a threefold aspected reality, incomprehensible to this finited gross being, and yet this being arose within it, which means that it was a potential of the absolute to cause existences. So there's an equation between the ab in absolute, the Father, as the generator, and the devil as he who has this whole world in his grip, because the grip is the creative fiat, force that is holding everything together, the force of coherence of all beings, the cause of our physical body, the fact that our physical body is a persistent stimulus to us. It's a nuisance, it's a devil. Nevertheless, it has a purpose. The devil is let loose for a time, time and a half time, and so on. Now, that grip could not be broken by this absolute force because it is totally unaware of it. So a mediating force has to be set up of such a low vibration relatively to the sensual one that its impulse is coming onto the earth, break it up. They produce changes in it, and they begin, these solar forces, to activate on the earth, and in conjunction with the lunar forces, which are rotating around it, and acting upon the fluids, the two of them together as positive and negative produce here organization of being. You know that all the form that is on earth is light form involved and aided by the substantial reinforcing influences of the moon. So we have a negative substantial body aspect and a positive radiating force aspect of will in our own organism. This solar energy has broken down the earth and produced plants growing up. in conjunction with the effect of the moon on the fluids in the plants, it has produced organic meat. And through processes, it has produced an animal. And it has produced man. The forces here are mediating forces, saving forces. Therefore, there's an equation between the S-U-N and the S-O-N. The sun is the sun. So it is said quite accurately that the primitive people who were sun worshippers were accurate to worship the sun, because it was actually the saviour of the human race at that level of consciousness. It and its force coming in gave them the possibility of attaining consciousness, clarity and so on, and it organized with the moon flux the chemicals in the fluids and produced organic life and is in process of lifting. Now you can see from that diagram the meaning of the two paths in the Hindu system, and the sun path, Suryayana, and the Pitriyana, the moon path. A person is either needing further physical evolution or considers itself now ready for volitional freedom. If it considers itself materially needing further experience, its consciousness is always turning back onto the earth. It is an earthbound consciousness. Now the dominion of the Saturnine impression is up to the limit of the moon. This is why Gurdjieff places the moon as a term. The forces, gravitational, go up to the level of the moon. The moon is circulating, captured by the earth, so that if any person who has formed a body out of his gross material body is still interested in the earth, when those aspects which organize him lift him out of the body of death, when they lift him, his interest curves him, and he goes no farther than the sphere of the moon. And he rotates in this Pitriyana, this moon sphere, and he goes on rotating round here for a period until he has absorbed the significance of the experiences that he had derived from his five sense life. When their significance is exhausted, he falls again and reincarnates. And that is the meaning of the Pitriyana. You get interested in the material world and you want to come back. The solar energy, which gave you all the light and the understanding, because you didn't develop it enough, it hasn't enough influence on you. You leave the body, you rise, but you can't climb beyond the lunar sphere. So you rotate within that sphere. I have to read diagrammatically there, it's more complicated than that. Imagine a zone around the earth in which the moon is circulating as a special frequency band. Every height from the earth has its own frequency. It is a special frequency band. And the person still interested in the earth and in physical generation cannot go beyond it. So he circulates round there with the moon until he has exhausted the interest of his previous earth experience. He then feels faint. He hasn't got any further kick. So he cannot keep circulating around there anymore. He hasn't got the energy to do it. He needs a certain amount of energy to carry him into that sphere. So he loses impetus. And he then falls into the earth, and somewhere, some other person with the same tendencies is very, very busy creating a body into which that soul falls and is then reincarnated. That is the lot of every person still interested in the earth and in physical generation. There are two ways of being interested in physical generation. One is because you're interested in it for its fun and games aspect, the sensual interest, and the other is because the Messiah has got to be born physiologically and there's a duty to be done. There aren't many people that have this duty concept. But no person who is tied by the earth can go beyond there. but a being who has got the power from the sun in the will such that he has broken his terrestrial interest. At death he goes to the sun, and now he circulates, you know, the sun is traveling, he circulates in the sphere of the sun. He could, if he willed, and occasionally some do, will back to the earth to help some of those patriotic beings and remind them there is something other than this. Now, there is a great cyclical process such that from the moment of the compression of the earth, a definite amount of energy is involved in the initial compression, and therefore a definite temporal development, and therefore a possibility of prophecy, because the cycle is determined by the initial amount of energy involved in it. And when all that energy has fulfilled its purpose such that no further interest is held by the beings on it for the earth, then the Saturnine impression is broken. The earth incandesces and becomes a sun, and all the beings then on it are volitional, by which time that moon will have moved out and constitute a new earth, and a new centre will be formed around that with a new moon on it. The process is eternal. Now, there's no hurry. You see, it's important to realise that time has its purpose. Saturn, the principle of time, Chronos, Saturn, Chronos, is in order that you should develop free will. His worship, the Absolute, his worship is perfect freedom. He doesn't care how long you take, because you can only take time, and he doesn't function in time, he functions eternally. We don't want to get out quicker than we can get out properly. So we're not going to panic about it. But we're not going to do what the Hindus did with their concept of reincarnation and say we won't bother this time, we'll do a bit next time. We are actually going to prefer, because of certain evolutionary forces involved in us, by the error of the Hindus. We are the recipients of their errors and therefore of the benefits of the errors. We are going to climb out and prefer to be free. The concept of free self-determination, not lower egoic determination, that is reaction. Free will, self with a capital S. We are going to do that. In order to do it, we must understand that whenever there is a material hard surface like that, the skin on an apple, the skull in the head, and so on, it means that there is a force coming down and a force inside trying to push it out. There's an egoic center. And that is a firmament. And this is the waters below the firmament, this is the waters above the firmament. And we have to bring all this into our consciousness so that we do not try to get rid of bondage prematurely. We deliberately work on the physical body we have in the only profitable way of working. That is, we use the body as a permanent reference point. We know it's satanic. Satanic. S. T. And motion. The self crucified serpent. That is Satan. We know that it's satanic because nothing could constrain it to crucify. It has compressed itself and crucified itself. And as we saw last week, we are responsible for our own existence. We have will to exist. We are responsible for us. And therefore, we should accept the limitations imposed on us simply because they annoy the appetite in us. Because out of the annoyance, or the angst and sorrow, the turbulence of our central serpent, eventually comes the flash of realization. It cannot come any other way. So every bit of friction, every kind of opposition we can get from other people without energy expenditure exceeding it, pranas, is again and a movement towards ultimate condescence. When that condescence occurs properly, and we have this in our mind, what is called purana, perfect crystallization of the soul occurs. And all wise men are identical. They can't make a distinction because what they know is the same everyone knows, namely the absolute of us. Whereas, if we take the five-point in and integrate on that, it is a false integration. Because the finite, five sense, has been fed serially in the time process and is necessarily wrong. So that to formulate prematurely out of your five sense dika is to create a hell body for yourself. So we don't want to do it. What we want to understand is nothing less than the absolute. And the absolute appears to us as a primary polarization in order to appear. It is going to be appearance, a bi-ratio function, a rationally graspable proposition that must polarize itself as energy and substance. But those are two aspects of a non-rational, not an irrational, a non-rational, non-ratioed reality absolute. That is the end. This is the pure crystal body, the Vajra, also the thunderbolt body you find in Buddhism. It is the pure light body of many Christian esotericists and so on. It is crystalline, it is like a diamond, it is hard, it is all sorts of things from different aspects. Because it is unbreakable, because it is a realization of the absolute, non-discrete source of all things. The absolute is not made of parts. It's a non-discrete reality. The element is the non-discretion. The apparent discretion is the ra in real. It is simply a vibration. So if you want to pronounce, there's the root of the mouth, the firmament in the head, there is the tongue, we put them up there. If we let it rattle, it's the letter R. If we just drag it along, it's L. When it rattles, it means to differentiate. When it drags, it means to join together again. It is formed in exactly the same place on the palate, and therefore the word real is really one letter, appearing as a link synthetic factor and differentiated elements to be linked, presupposing a pre-analysis absolute reality, appearing in the time process as elements projected temporally, serially, and then linked together, and in the linkage synthesizing a whole made out of discrete elements. And the synthetic whole is the discrete elements plus the awareness of the absolute reality behind it. Now that is real. And this Lord of the ancients is exactly the same thing. The Lord or wisdom of the ancients is simply, it's different, not different. The law that we know of is based on this. The law of man is derived in bits from it. Law is all the same. This, we can create a difference in this case. You see, there's a way whereby we can define the situation. Because it's all the same, really. Those people who can't differentiate will pay fees to those who can. And those who cannot differentiate are like L instead of R. Now you'll notice that when a child cannot differentiate properly, it says L. You can't say this, it says that. You'll notice that certain people, like the Parisians and the Austrians and others, pronounce an R on the soft palate, as opposed to a Scottish one on the tip. The nearer it is to the teeth, the more intellectual it is. So a trilled R on the teeth is intellectual differentiation, and a uvular R, where the uvula flaps in the breeze, is only gullical differentiation. It's a primary differentiation of the gullet that's occurring. It isn't as clear as the one that you do on your teeth. And you'll notice in general, people in southern parts are less formal than they are on the teeth. Because the northern parts are harder, the terrain is harder, the living is harder. You've got to discriminate more. Where it's easy, there's less necessity for discrimination. And lazy R's come. You can hardly pronounce it. Unless there's a need for differentiation. So, that again is a good reminder. The word real, the word lower, the old form of it, the lar, is a nice place in Scotland called Largs. And if you go there, you will find some pillars with funny measurements. And they give you evidence of exactly the same law. And this lovely word where this G becomes K, lark, is exactly the same thing. The lark that goes in the sky is derived from the same idea. A lark is simply an intellectual play, as opposed to a lark, which is a gross material application. So for a lark, first of all, you must know the lark, the gross law, and then you must insert a little twist, an intellectual twist into it. See it in a new way, that's called a lark. That little dicky bird that flies off the surface of the earth like this is really driven by a force, a solar force. Let this dicky bird rise this way now. And when the little lark is up there, it has actually been elevated by a light force from the sun, which you can hear trilling in it, shouting R in the top of its voice. And going up and up and up and up until it's tired and comes down again. It's actually lifted. Now, remember that these forces are the forces that are lifting the plant world, the animal world, the man world, and they're being opposed for a time, times and half a time, a soon a half, isn't it? So that the process and the purpose of the gross material world shall be fulfilled. When it is all fulfilled, that is the consummation of day. The adding up of the little impulses that were predicted in, then fly out again. Incandescence, release. Then that sun is the center, the throne spirit, round which are other beings in their hierarchies. Up to the limit where the planet is. And a change of phase where that planet is. And then another planet of different density. Now, is that fairly clear?
Would you name Appetite 3, as you mentioned there, with the Suryama, after the reciprocal feeding principle?
The recognition of it?
Yes.
Yes. Because if you don't realise that actually you are biting yourself, if you bite another person, it is only because they have made you realise that you are impotent. You have no other reason to bite them. If they remind you of your deficiencies, then you bite. Maybe you're biting yourself, but you can't inhibit it. You haven't the power, so it flies out and bites that person. And as soon as it's bitten, if you're watching, you know you made a mistake. It should have been turned back on you and bitten you and said, that was a wrong technique at least. How to do it better next time? The whole of the law consists in catching that thing and bringing it back. Bring it back. Reflection. On the drawing underneath there, you know, so I put the man bent round the zodiac and the feet reflects our memories, I think. Mm-hmm. The feet were touching the head. The feet are under the dominion of Christmas, fish, which means emotion. The emotional life expresses itself in wigglings of the toes at its turn. The more you try to control it up here, the more it is forced down the body until you get leg reflex and so on. So if you place the whole man round there, the genital centre is in Scorpio, under the dominion of Mars. The initial energies of Aries are also under the dominion of Mars. Fiery energy in the absolute has bound itself in Taurus, has divided itself in Germany. One half has chased the other half in cancer. This cancer sign, you see, is that. One part is trying to eat the other part. There's two fish, two claws, and one crab at the top. One part is pursuing the other part, in the same way that the nervous system is pursuing the blood system, and the blood system is pursuing the nervous system. And this is the cause of degeneration, as the Chinese version of it. And then, in that capturing, is the soulish life, the flesh. And that light then goes into Leo, where the being becomes a being, light, and conscious that to him there's nothing so important as to be free. So a person born in Leo has freedom, but he cannot really operate except from himself. He's gone beyond the level where he can be merely passive. He must do so. Because he's a will being, he wills to complete his education. He wills into Virgo. Now that's all around the tummy, the navel, and the intestine, and the like. And willing into that, he's absorbing, and he then has to balance in Libra. See? Whatever comes into him then, he must equilibrate it, balance it, assess it, weigh it, etc. When it is weighed, he will then decide that some of it is worthy of generation. And the generation can be either in an external physical act, a demonstration of the truth, or it can be sexually, when you make a gross physical body for another soul to inhabit. The choice appropriate to you, if you remember the aim, which is Sagittarian. The thighs are the recipients of the main drives to go, so that this energy applied shall be furthered. And it pushes you into a situation where the knees in Capricorn are brought to bend. You know, at the back of the neck, the popliteal arch and the hamstrings. If you want to drive into a situation, you must bend the knee because the situation exists. You must accept it. You find people getting stiff knees when they are in the situation that they are refusing.
The tape at this point ran out, the original tape. So I'm presenting a resume of how the work developed from this point. We've seen that in Libra, certain choices have been made. And now in Sagittarius, we see the choice appropriate to you. If you remember the aim, which is Sagittarius, the thighs are the recipients of the main drives to go, so that this energy applied shall be furthered if it pushes you into a situation where the knees in Capricorn are brought to bend. If you want to drive into a situation, you must bend the knee because the situation exists. You must accept it. You find people getting stiff knees when they're in a situation that they're refusing. So here in Capricorn, the cardinal earth sign, which as we know symbolizes a stress on the material absorption, such people are orientated towards the gross material world. We refer to it for authority for their position. And if we compare it with the one immediately opposite, Cancer, which is the cardinal water sign, symbolizes the feeling life. This person does not refer to the external world, but to his own feelings for authority. In relationship, the Capricornian would say, I know so and so. Because it exists in the material world, and I require you to recognize the material world as an essential reference point. I remember they're talking to the cancer feeling type. They could go on to say, you must be practical. You must be down to earth. Well, the cancer might reply, I'm not concerned with the external material world, but with my feelings. Because although the material world may exist, as far as I'm concerned, it has no value unless I feel it to have. Thus the cancer type refuses to accept as basic that which the Capricorn type calls fundamental. So until they could agree on a common basis, there could be no possible understanding between them. It's as if a welfare worker, a Capricornian, say, goes to visit a cancer type. The welfare worker will say, we must be practical. We must realize that we live in a material world. So we must take care of the material facts of life and put them in order. We must conform to the social structure in which we live. The cancer type would immediately feel that everything that had been said was irrelevant to the inner state of his cancer position. Now, when we start to apply a force in the form of words to a being, we are starting to shift the stress of that being, and there will arise in his consciousness different contents according to the stimuli presented. We must therefore familiarize ourselves with the meaning of every term. And when listening to another person, try to place the center out of which the statement he makes is coming. So if we use the example we've just used, if a person does start to talk about material security and the necessity for accepting things that come to us and absorbing them, then we will know that the earth triad in that being is speaking. You already have a social concept with a name inscribed upon it, with which you're identified, and which you think is yourself. But that self is the lower self. It is a construct which is purely mechanical and will misinterpret anything that goes on in the mind. So first of all, you have to do an exercise which we call Watch the Monkey Jump. You'll discover when you look in the mind that every time a stimulus comes, the mind reacts. And the egoic center says something about the thing, such as, I like it, or I don't like it, or it's rubbish, so on. If you interfere with it prematurely, you will never discover the rubbish, because the conceptual self, the egoic self, will distort every interpretation and make it fit the pattern that is pleasant to the egoic self. Do not try to control it at first. Simply watch. You're the witness, the watcher, the observer. You are not the observed. You'll hear a lot of voices at first. They're simply the memory traces of all the people you've ever known in your life who've talked in your presence, saying things about different subjects. You'll hear all this. plus the memory of the things you thought whilst they have said them. All these exist in the mind and constitute a lot of rubbish. If you watch the mind long enough, you'll become disgusted with it, because it is mechanical. It has nothing useful to say to you at all. Now, when you're perfectly convinced of this, then you are ready to control it. But not until. Now, at this point, you can go inside through the determinative faculty, the intellect proper, which then points out that although the mind is full of rubbish, nevertheless, that rubbish is made up of little bits of truth, which are in wrong context. And the bits themselves are very sensible. It's simply the rubbish is the wrong relation between those bits. It's a faulty relation between the bits that makes them rubbish, not the things themselves. All the ideas you have, including the hybrid and mythical monsters, are quite valid at their own level. But they are not so when you put them in wrong relation. The determinative faculty, the pure intellect inside you, will tell you just how to relate them so there's no longer any rubbish, and yet the elements are exactly what they were before. So say you see a kind of horse with wings. Well, it's rubbish unless you realize that it is a symbol. It's a symbol of power. The animal power of the horse, or drive. The air, or intellectual power, symbolized by the bird. Thus, Pegasus means an intellectual power. So once you realize that Pegasus is not a terrestrial animal, but a mythical idea or representation of an intellectual or volitional function, then it's no longer rubbish. The determinative faculty will put all the mind in order. Now, once we've penetrated through the determinative faculty, we'll discover the spirit immanent within. It's on the inside, not the outside. So only when you've penetrated through the pure intellect itself will you come to the immanent spirit, which is free. That is free will. Now the last thing you'll learn about the formulator, the intellect, is that itself only deals with subject and predicate, and has the equation subject equals predicate. The full statement of the subject exhausts the subject. This means that the predicate is implied in the subject, so that once you've made the name of the subject, the predicate is an implication of the name of the subject. So the higher intellect has on its inmost side its final statement that the totality of the predicate is the totality of the subject, or S, subject, equals P, predicate. Beyond that, there's nothing to say. There's only free will, which is initiative energy. Can initiate any change whatever, because it's not mechanical. It's not conditioned by the subject and predicate. The subject is itself a precipitate of power, which is absolutely will. And the predicate is simply a rational statement about the subject. Predication means this. It means rational statement about that subject. So there's nothing in the subject other than that which the will has put into it. That's tremendously important. Consider that carefully. There's nothing in the subject other than that which the will has put into it. There's a conflict in the Roman Church between the Franciscans and the Dominicans. The Dominicans think that the reason is prior to the will. But the Franciscans say that the will is prior to reason or intellect. Because they say if God's intellect were prior to his will, then his will would have to obey his intellect, and his will would not then be free. Now the word Franciscan means free. They prefer this freedom to the dome of the intellect. So they say the will is prior to the reason. The Dominicans try to make will obey the reason. And they have a very peculiar fact to account for. That is, when people know a truth, they do not necessarily will to act upon it. Do you see that? If the intellect was prior to the will, they would have to act on it. And as many people know what ought to be done and don't do it, this establishes that the will is prior to the reason. Now Pisces, which completes our circle, is a water sign, a feeling sign. At its lower level, it is emotion, very wet, a lot of tears, but its highest sign, it is compassion. Its opposite, as we've touched upon, is Virgo, an earth sign, a stress on matter. Thus, if we go through all these processes, we arrive finally at the immanent spirit. And we find at the center of every being, there is free will. Thus, if it is an earth sign, we must soften up just a bit. Remember, our aim, our motive, is to help these other beings onto center. It's not to attempt to manipulate them to our advantage. That's not the name of the game at all. So if it is an earth sign, we're attempting to soften up a bit, then we felt sympathetically. That's the water sign. Then we must penetrate the reason and the determinative faculty, the determinative intellect, give it reasons. That's the air sign. And finally, point out to it, you are a free will, so you don't have to take any notice. But if you freely will to antagonize other beings within the social structure, then they will restrain you. So you're appealing to this free will, and if you cannot convince a person of free-willed activity, then you cannot really convert that person at all. Therefore, the thing to aim at is the introduction of the awareness of free will into that being, and that all other beings round also have free will. Therefore, if it does not will in the proper manner, then all the other beings will back again to his restraint.
anatomy of your mouth closed, and that shows you that it refers to that which can be enclosed. When you pronounce M, you are blocking your mouth up with tone, and this tone itself signifies substance. It feels like substance. I tell you, you're blocking your mouth up, but actually you're blocking the whole structures of the mouth and the zones above the palate, including the sinuses, which are the source of the tone. But it signifies substance, and the O following it signifies a finite zone, voided, and the two together, substance, void, signifies appetite and circumscribing. In Ma, you have the same thing, only in A, the energy comes in. So Ma means substantial energy as appetite, but it's simply energy conceived. In Mo, the energy has turned A to O and is therefore circumscribing and therefore limiting the appetite. The letter T signifies a cross. It's quite permissible to write your T like a Greek cross or like a Latin cross or anyhow you like. So, mata or mokta signifies the appetite crucified. The vowel I behind it is a point, and that is the point at which the appetite aims itself. And this point has certain potentialities in it, namely the letter V, and those potentialities will develop and you will become aware of the field of operations for actualization of the potentials of the situation. So motive means a substantial appetite crucifying itself by aiming at a particular, believing that particular contains developmental possibilities of field experience. Now, motivational research in America at the moment is putting millions of dollars out of some hands into some pockets. And it is based on a very simple proposition which can be conceived in a non-spiritual way simply as the product of the behaviour of energies. We'll do it in this way first. An energy can travel along, translate without turning. If it does, it makes nothing whatever. But if it turns, it makes a zone in which it has turned. Now the energy involving itself in the zone is reactive to any stimulus, that is further energy, coming to it from outside. The energy coming from outside, striking against the zone of rotating energy, is called the stimulus. The receiving zone is the stimulated. When the stimulus hits this receiving zone, the energy of the stimulus travels through it, and the substance itself, which is power involved, responds to the stimulus. Now you can see immediately that if we analyse the thing merely at a power level, without considering the function of free will, that every power zone must respond to a stimulus. In fact, this word must itself tells you about it. The substance, power, issues forth and again is crucified on its mode of response. It's the technical term for the way the male elephant must behave when he's chasing a lady elephant. He's said to be on must, and it means that the substance in him has certain energies that are trying to come out and driving him about. So when we say something must respond, we mean there is a substantial power there, mu, that the stimulus hitting it induces a change, that this change is unavoidable, and therefore the receiving substance must respond. If we consider that in terms of will, we could say that it might be possible for a receiving substance, if the substance is power and power is will, for that receiving substance to inhibit its response. It would feel the stimulus and then get hold of itself and modify itself so that it did not act mechanically to the stimulus. But as far as present day motivational research is concerned, it is convenient to eliminate the concept of will in order to keep the analysis simple. You may remember that Lewis Carroll wrote a poem called The Hunting of the Snark. Now, a snark is a being that is arced and negated. It is a spirit negated by arcing. They are hunting the snark. They want the snark to pay taxes. That is, to respond to a stimulus by giving back to the source of the stimulus. But every being has in its centre immanent spirit, and that is a guarantee that the snark isn't really a snark, but a boojum. Well, this boojum means the boo that you say to a goose, and the divine affirming power in the substance. So when the income tax man is chasing the snark, and Carroll says at the end, it's very dangerous hunting snarks because they might not be snarks at all. If it happens that it isn't a snark, but a boojum, the income tax man will disappear. It says at the end, when they knew he disappeared, searching for it, and they followed him into the place where he was last seen, he had disappeared. He had softly and silently vanished away, for the snark was a boojum, you see. To be, therefore, a boojum, one must be able to inhibit the response. If one cannot inhibit the response, one is a snark. Now, we have a substance, we'll eliminate the boojum part for a moment because it complicates the analysis by making the whole thing quite worthless. So we won't mention the little hole in the middle, and we'll pretend in this diagram that there isn't one. So that when the stimulus comes, the whole of the being responds, acts back towards the origin of the stimulus. And it must do so if it's a snark. So we have to study the nature of the stimulus and the nature of the substance receiving the stimulus. And then by giving certain characterized stimuli, we can provoke certain kinds of reaction. We've said that if the stimulus comes at it fairly easily, at an assimilable rate, not too slow, not too fast, that it is coming at an assimilable rate causes pleasure. If it comes easily, it will give you pleasure, because it's coming in easily. If the stimulus comes very rapidly and heavily, then it comes in too fast, the organism begins to disrupt, and fearing this local disruption, it moves away from the source of the stimulus. So the stimuli are of two orders, assimilable and non-assimilable. Now let's look at the human being. He has three parts, and these three parts differ in their mode of action. Their substantial powers are therefore different. Down below we have a belly with a desire to eat and to reproduce. So food and sex are down below. So we can immediately give two orders of stimuli to this department. The stimulus based on the need for food, the stimulus based on the need for sex. Now most of present-day motivational research depends upon this fact that most human beings are orientated towards food and sex more than to anything else. But they do have some other things as well. Inside them, in the feeling department, they have plus and minus, they like and they dislike. They have a need for an emotional value. So we can give them stimuli that make them feel good, stimuli to make them feel bad. In advertising, this is very important, even to make them feel bad. If you are advertising an insecticide, you do a drawing of a strange creature with many legs sitting on your sandwich, and then say DDT will clean up your sandwich for you. You fire a very horrible stimulus, and then a pleasant one, freedom from these multi-legged creatures. Now, also, the man is a rational being, and therefore you can give him formal stimuli of a rational order. You can actually hit a man in his rational department by saying, this thing actually works. It's made of cogwheels and bits of wire and things, and they all go together, and they're quite rational, and we can tell you this thing works. That's a positive stimulus to buy it, and other things don't work so well, that's a negative stimulus, not to buy somebody else's. So we have here three levels of stimuli, and already the situation becomes quite complicated. We can hit people at the level of food, sex, romantic pleasures of value, feeling needed, loved, and so on, and rational ones, appeal to the self-opinion of the rational part of the man. Now that's basic to motivational research for human beings. If we had to do motivational research for selling things to amoebae, we would have to cut the thing down very simply to assimilable foods and non-assimilable, and our mode of advertising would be to drop a bit in the water in a certain position and get them migrating towards that department before we put the net in and scoop them out and eat them. Here are the three levels. Now let's examine them more closely. We know that if we go down to the belly band, there is a tube going up from it that finishes on the mouth. Some of these things are not to be mentioned at all, of course, because in good society we don't discuss anything below the diaphragm. But in this particular thing, to be quite truthful, we have a tube which is an extension of the appetite centre, and we have what we might call an ovipositor down below, and these two things are very closely linked, because the amount of food we eat has a relation with the number of sexual elements that we generate. This is true of the male. The female has a full quota when she's born, so she doesn't need to go through certain operations as a man does. We can therefore see that because there's a link between eating and sexuality, because in order to beget children you need food, and therefore the more you eat, the more surplus energy of food there is, the more pressure there is down below, the more tendency there will be to become aware of sexual impulses. And you can see that the child has to be fed also, and therefore if you make a child you'll have to start considering food. So sex and eating are very closely linked. So you can give a stimulus to do with food, and by implication invoke sex. If in the advertising campaign you draw a lady bending over a hot kitchen stove, and this lady is in a certain posture, which I have deliberately not drawn in this picture, then the stimulus given on the eye causes the man who's thinking about the sorrows of labouring over a hot kitchen stove, as he thinks about the food, he's thinking about something else at the same time. And this something else causes him to prefer one of the 57 varieties to another. And sometimes even quite simple phonetic things cause this. For instance, all the pulses, the peas and the beans, and so on, enjoy a high sale because of the function of P and B. And this P function, which is one of the pulses, is similar to the seed, the egg, in the human being, and it has chemistry related to those things. And there are unconscious, very ancient associations that cause the need for sexual relations to act backwards and make one start eating peas and beans. The peas and beans being a substitute for the other thing and a preparation for it if it comes along. Now, let's examine a little more carefully. There are three main anxieties in the human being. And the anxieties are the fear of death, the fear of meaninglessness, lack of significance, and the fear of getting locked up. The theologians would call that the fear of condemnation. Let's put them down. Death, condemnation, significance, and the nice very lucky. Right. We have three anxieties here, and they're very useful in motivational research. Death itself is a fact that occurs all around us, and it means the breaking of the physical body. And this breaking of the physical body is out of total, as when you get rolled over by a very large, heavy traction engine, or partial, when you get attacked by a disease or locally thumped. Death is a threat to your physical body. And in this threat is a very, very potent stimulus. Children see death. And the first death they see, maybe of a pussycat or a dog or of a dear old aunt or something in the family, that first death impresses profoundly the child's mind. It's something quite alien to its own life. And it rejects it. It just wants to see it. To take a child in to see a dead person is to introduce a tremendously powerful shock into the child's organism. One minute she's talking to Aunt Florence, and the next minute she's not talking anymore. She looks like wax, she doesn't smell nice, and she's hard and cold. And she's not replying anymore. There's no more pennies, no more chocolate, nothing. And it is called death. This is a tremendous shock to a child. Everybody's seen death in some order, and one identifies in measure with everything one sees. Therefore, when you see death, you identify with it, and you don't like it. This is locked up inside you as a negative stimulus. So to present any suggestion of death to a person is to strike on a zone in their being which is very, very painful and very fear-provoking. And that kind of anxiety, fear of death, can be and is overcome by what we call the heroic mentality, who will go out and say, "Death, oh glory, I prefer the glory. I will risk the death." And in a war, everybody faces death. So the fact of death isn't so powerful as another thing. When we consider the possibility of condemnation with damning, that is to say, there's society, and you push somebody out of society, and you won't let them back into society, all those who are here together damn another person, push him out, they get rid of him. If he's inside here, and they don't want to lose him for some function, and they don't like his other functions, they damn him internally, but he's still condemned. Now this condemnation, in a peculiar sense, is almost worse than death. Because death, at least, you might cease to exist. And then you're not there to worry anymore. But in condemnation, you are still there, but completely inhibited. And you'll notice that the fear of condemnation, as presented by religious teachings of certain orders, has a more powerful effect than the fear of death. It is possible to say to a person, "You are condemned if you do not fight to the death." And so powerful is the meaning of the word condemn that the man threatened with the word condemn will move towards the fact of death rather than suffer the consequences of the condemnation word. So this fear of condemnation gives you again an opportunity for giving a double stimulus. In the case of death, you can threaten people with it, and that frightens them. Or you can promise to remove the causes, and that pleases them. In the case of condemnation, you promise to release them from condemning activities. You're in the wrong church. They condemn a certain act. I've made a special church for you where nothing is condemned. So you can belong without being condemned. So we give you a stimulus that says, concerning condemnation, of which everybody is afraid, we offer you belongingness without condemnation in a special church that has no rules. Everybody wants to join this church. On the other hand, you can't say condemnation is certain and inevitable in a given situation and play upon all the embodied impulses of the collective unconscious, the tradition of the race embodied in you. Now, apart from condemnation and death, this other one, this question of significance, is tremendously strong. Supposing a person is threatened with death, you can say, "Well, never mind death, I condemn you if you don't fight." And they will say, "All right, I will fight." But supposing the person is being condemned and they're managing to endure the condemnation, and you suddenly say to them, your condemnation is without significance. This is a more powerful stimulus. It actually says that your condemnation is a farce. It's quite ridiculous. You are condemned, that's a fact, but it is meaningless. Now, meaninglessness, lack of significance, is far worse to bear than either condemnation or death. If you say to a man who's prepared to face death, you are facing death, but it's meaningless. What are you facing it for? Well, for my children in the future. But this is silly. All your children are going to face death for their children, and so on, to eternity. So it's meaningless. Because if everybody is sacrificing themselves for everybody else, the whole thing is a colossal machinery of sacrifice, and there's no meaning. At this point, it becomes not even worthwhile living, never mind dying. So we will say that significance is central to the being. We'll put down in the belly land death, we'll put significance in the heart region, and we'll put condemnation in the head region. And that will line up our three functions again. Death is very closely linked to sex and food. Food is to prevent death. Sex is to reproduce, so that in the event of the death of this organism, another organism conquers death. In the realm of condemnation, we are concerned with deeming or judging. Here today are men, there are men called deemsters. They are men who know how to damn. And the condemnation department, of course, is in this rational level. So that it is possible to threaten a man with death by depriving him of food, and to threaten him of lack of continuance, and therefore death complete, by depriving him of the sexual organs that could reproduce him. So that at that level, a rabbi would say, a man with no children is really dead when he dies. Whereas a man with children is not really dead, because his protoplasm is still surviving, and he can resonate with his own protoplasm and re-embody himself very easily in his own line if he's got one. So the statement, a man with no children is really dead when he's dead, which is a rabbinical statement, is very true. In the level of condemnation, we see everything depends on deeming, damning, judging. We have to divide the substance in order to judge. It is an analytical function. If we provide a man with food and the opportunity of sexual reproduction, there is no threat to him really. So if we want to make, during a war, lots of coup rage, all we have to do is provide the soldiers with plenty of food and at the same time tell them there are girls in the next territory waiting for impregnation. And that if they don't go and kill the enemy are coming to impregnate their ladies, and thus to establish their own continuance on this side of the border. By presenting such stimuli, people can be and are motivated by the million into actions that lead to self-destruction. When you come into the condemnation level, the analytical level, the intellectual level, all you have to do is appeal to the egotism of the rationalist. Now obviously this is more important to a man than a woman. A man is head and nerve stressed, like a woman is stressed in the feeling and urge below, and blood stressed. So when you attack at the level of a rational stimulus, you are merely appealing to a being who is identified with the rational processes. That being will respond positively if you praise his intelligence. You do a drawing of a certain commodity and you put a heading, all intelligent men are buying X. As everybody, every male is intelligent, naturally he buys it. And if you say, no intelligent man would think of doing so and so, that is using the wrong lacquer on the fireplace or something, then as he happens to be no intelligent man, he wouldn't be doing that sort of thing. We can see here that the condemnation function acts more on the man than a woman. So we find that in churches there's more effect on the conscience of a man, because he has more conscience, because conscience is common science, namely head information, then there is an act of condemnation on a woman. It takes an awful lot of condemning statements to stick on a woman. She can look condemned, she can say she's condemned, but if you don't keep a strong grip on her, when you go out of the room, she'll be uncondemned immediately. And that, of course, they were aware in the days of chivalry of this and invented the iron chastity belt because of it. When it comes to the realm of significance, both men and women are equally get-at-able. That is to say, they like to think that they're meaningful. So that really, to insult somebody's significance is to depress them. And to praise their significance is to lift them right into the skies. You remember Struve, his little man, with his bowler hat on. Really, this tiny little figure with the bowler on walking about. He is carrying the weight of the country. He's only a little man, and he's called the little man. And yet, somehow, in all the cartoons, this little man is smiling, and he's got tremendous loads of taxes on his head, but he's still smiling. Obviously, he's significant. Because he's got a big load on his head and he's not crushed. And with the aid of a little cartoon of that order, millions of people can be kept cheerful. Every time you present a stimulus, the receiver identifies with it. That's the only way that he can know that there is a stimulus, namely by identification. If you make it positive, he'll feel good, he'll feel expansive, and he will feel, this I should identify with. And he will then tend to do the act suggested along with this present stimulus. If we fire a stimulus triangular at a receiving being, the being goes into a triangular form, and the vibrations inside him convey triangularity. Supposing that triangle is painful, and we have another mode of stimulation, a round one, which is not painful, it's got no sharp corners on it, and so the being feels round and it recognizes this. Now, we get a sharp, biting substance, and we wrap round it some sugar. This is how to take your bitter pill. So that when the eye perceives the external, it gets a message, I can swallow this, and therefore it opens itself to it. The stimulus goes in, the covering is melted off, and then suddenly it is very sharp. So it says in the Bible, he swallowed a little book, and lo, it was sweet in the mouth, but bitter in the belly. That means you can read the Bible pleasantly, but if you are not careful, and you actually swallow the Bible, if it gets into you seriously, it will act very bitterly upon you. Bitterly means it will reduce you to bits. It will analyze you. It will sift you as wheat, as it says. This is a fact, that the word going into you, the stimulus going into you, sifts you. It actually shakes your substance, vibrates you. Any word with the letter A in it vibrates all A's in your being. Anyone with B vibrates all B's. So all the words inside you are resounding to other words with those constituent elements in them. And when this is realized, then it becomes possible, by careful meditation upon the nature of man, his threefold nature, to come out of a mechanical level, to realize that the mode of escape is to break down the complex stimuli fired at us, and to sort out that which is sugar on the pill from the bitter center of the pill. Now, it's that sufficient for some questions.
Well, we have three stimuli there which can turn you in every respect, I take it, but what is the significance of those three stimulus from the point of getting free? How can you utilize them in terms of freeing yourself?
Well, once you've understood that this mode of your substance is responding to a stimulus, and you remember that the observer is not the observed, then no matter what kind of stimulus there is in the body, you say it is a stimulus response, and as such I'm not interested.
Yes, but if you have then withstood those three basic stimuli, you must have got fairly well into the observer position, I should think.
I should think so, yeah. If you haven't, of course, there's still more work to be done.
Yeah.
You should actually be able to look at something essentially desirable. That is to say, something that's really good, looks good, smells good, functions well, and so on. And it's presented to you, but because it is presented, you say, well, I'm not interested. Because your freedom is more important to you than the involvement in that situation. This does not mean that you won't eat the apple. It does mean that you're not interested in the apple when you're eating it.
Mm.
You see, it's possible actually to have your din-din and to appreciate it without being tied to it. You see, there's a plate, and on it there's a nice sausage cooked by a very good-looking girl. Now, these three are presented simultaneously. The sausage is a mystery in any case. The plate is quite open. And here's another mystery here in the form of a beautiful lady. They're all presented simultaneously. Now, supposing you happen to be hungry at the moment, and supposing because you are hungry, sausage goes into the belly department, and because you're a bit protopathic, that is, you're not properly evolved yet, you haven't sorted out the different elements of your being, you think that the plate has something to do with the sausage, and that the hand holding the plate has something to do with the plate, and that the girl holding the hand has something to do with the hand, and therefore the girl has something to do with the sausage. So you enjoy the sausage, and you then think you owe a wedding ring to the girl. You see the kind of thing that goes on. Now, if you can sort it out, you see, you can keep your entities separate. If you don't sort it out, it's like going to bed with a sausage on a plate.
Could you say something about the death wish referred to by psychologists when they talk about the death wish for an individual?
Well, there are two ways of looking at the death wish. What you might call the naive, materialistic, psychological way. Where the death wish comes when the individual fails and can conceive no method whatever of succeeding, and therefore has become void of significance. So he says, I might as well get out because I'm no good. Nobody likes me. They don't like the zooming aura I give out. Nobody kisses me. Nobody buys me lots of chocolate. And really, I'm dead already. So I might as well cut myself. Now that's a negative death wish. You could say that the Freudian death wish is similar to that. It is the wish of a man who has failed. But there's another kind of death wish, the death wish of the mystic. He says that the individual five-pointed man is already dead. And yet somehow he's involved in this fellow. He's got tied up with him. Where the heart is, there is the treasure also. And somehow this heart is interested in these five sense data, although they're in fact limiting factors on universal awareness. So he says that thing is really dead, it's a kind of machine. And I have a wish here to be dead to it. Now to be dead is already to be negative, so if I can become dead to the dead, I'll be a double negative, which is the absolute positive. And this positive death wish is exactly opposite to the other one, and it's a very laudable one. And it isn't a very popular one. And yet the two are exactly opposite concepts. The positive death wish of the mystic is simply that he wants to die to death. And as the Bard said, and then when that dying is done, when one has died that death, then there is no more dying. Because all finites are necessarily dead, they are cut off. Unless such they are finite, limited, powerless, and so on. So if you want to become not finite, not powerless, obviously you must negate the negation. The negation is your individuality. And therefore you say, I will die to it. And you can say it, and you'll find your enemy is inertia. The body is actually saying, well, I don't like being hurt, and I want something to eat. All these are self-preserving inertias in the organism. But once you have seen clearly that the finite organism is factually limiting your ascent to absoluteness, power and intelligence, then you really say, well, it's no good, it's a rotten instrument. I'll use it only as a reference point, but I will increase my field awareness. And as I get more and more aware of the field, so more and more data of other frequencies come into me, and I can see my way about much more clearly. So that I become progressively more and more dead to the dead, so I become more and more living to the life, which is the answer.
Yes, Gerhard mentions that one in his book, as opposed to the Freudian interpretation of it. And then he uses another interpretation where he says, in something like a sex act to the woman particularly, there is a death wish or a movement back into what he calls a oneness. He likens this as the most or the best example of a material situation to the mystic's death wish.
Yes.
A desire to return to the unity, to the totality is the word he uses.
Yes. Let's start with a single cell being and pretend this is the cosmic cell from which all other cells derive. It is the primary unity. Now, if it's going to remain one, and there's going to be no more than this one, relation is impossible. And without relation, there is no value. So somehow we must split this thing. We must divide ourselves to create value. But it needs a definite amount of energy to make the split, doesn't it? And a definite amount of energy to drive them apart. So there are now two beings held apart. And to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So there must be a pull back to center, exactly equivalent to the force that drove them apart. Now, is it a death wish? No, it depends what you mean by death.
Or is it the separativity?
It is a return wish at the psychological level, but dynamically, it's simply a fact that a strain has been induced, and therefore there is a stress. Now, obviously, if you come back, which in the sexual relation between a man and a woman is felt largely as a return to the prior unity. If you manage to do what you're trying to do, namely merge completely, if you succeed, you're wasting your time. Because at the moment of absolute dissolving of the two beings in each other, there won't be two beings and there'll be no relation. So it's much better to accept the fact of the attempt to dissolve the duality in the unity, rather than to attain the unity. If the unity is attained, there'll be no awareness in the dual beings trying to create it, that there is a tension. The tension will disappear. Whereas the exercise of trying to attain the unity, and the special tacit conspiracy that stops us from attaining it, that is valuable. So here comes another kind of anxiety. We need courage to accept our differences, the distance between us, and we need another kind of courage to face the possibility of losing our differences. See, most people like to belong when their energy level is low enough so that they tend to fall onto a common gravity center. And in this belongingness, all they are really demonstrating is that their energy is not yet sufficient to force them away from the center, to create a center. Now, the being who is just near a group and yet not in it is in an ambiguous position. If he moves away completely from the group, he will lose the stimulus he needs for his evolution. But if he does get the stimulus he needs to evolve, he has been driven away from the group. If he's driven away completely, he'll go into the void. And he has to have the courage to go into the void, ultimately. But if he has it prematurely, he might as well dive in a river and forget himself. On the other hand, to get experience, he must have the courage to enter into a group and not fear the loss of his individuality. And he must have both of these courages. He must have the courage to be isolated within the group and, at the same time, the courage to dare to be absorbed into the void. Because if he hasn't, then either of those facts can frighten him. The fear of the void can drive him into the group, in which case he's no good to the group. Or the fear of the group can drive him into the void, in which case he's no good in the void and can't integrate in it. They always run up against a paradoxical fact where simultaneously two things have to be done.
I ask you briefly about anagram.
Yes?
When you said all A's, five, you know, let's say 5 A's, all A's.
Yeah.
I thought then of anagram. Now, it means analyzing that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And,
yes. Or running them about.
Yes.
Rearranging them.
It's related to the word anal, which means analyzing, doesn't it?
It's the same Anna in analysis, yes. It really means a running course.
Really, two words with the same letters, according to that, would have the same effect on your other meaning.
Two words with the same letters?
Yes.
The same letters will have the same meaning on you, plus their relation with the new letter. For instance, when we take the letter R, it can be represented either with a comma that way or a comma this way. You see? In which case, it means increasing energy on the next side, decreasing energy on the sinister side. It is R with rising cadence, R with falling cadence. So the same letter itself has two values, positive and negative. Now supposing we put the same letter twice, A, it now has a meaning that it didn't have before. Namely, it means A there, and it means A here, but the second A is not quite the same as the first A, because it occupies a different place. It is formally like the first one, but it is locally different from the first one. And there now arises between them the possibility of another sign, and the sign of equality. A equals A. So as soon as you put two together, a third thing arises between them, the relation. And this relation is said, say by Jacob Burma, to be the son of the father and mother. And for the son and the father and mother to be superior to the father and mother seems to become illogical. Because the relation must contain the two terms plus something else. So ideally, if a man and a woman have a child, the child should be better than they are. Because whatever they've got in them that drives them together is fused in the child and is accessible to the child, so the child can, given the appropriate opportunity, understand the father-mother relation in itself, whereas the father cannot understand the mother outside himself, nor the mother the father outside herself. So as soon as we put two things together, we have a new emergent, the relation. If we take different things, we say ga and ang, that's the same letters read in two different ways, we get immediately a new significance. If we say that the first letter sounded shall represent the head of a temporal series, then ga means that a gamma, a gross substance, has given rise to an energy. So there's an opening process. Ga, close, a, open. Ga, close to open. If we go the other way, open to close. So we get a different significance out of the two letters. So even the order of the letters adds a meaning. There's an old magical word, agla. And it spells al ga, the other way, of course. This is a magical word because it means energy daring to grossly objectify itself, tying itself, working on itself, labouring on itself to regain its energy, plus the experience of having been guarded and loved, having been locked up and worked one's way out. So agla says a-a-ga-la. That is to say, absolute free energy, grossly blocked energy, labouring experience within the gross block in order to get out energy. So you should analyse a letter, the same letter, double, mysterious, A, which is an old way of saying it doesn't matter what you do as long as you do it. Because whatever you do, it's absolute, absolute, absolute. does not have its time or eternity. It is all power. And therefore, it doesn't really matter whether you chew a banana, scratch your left ear, wear a pair of purple socks. It doesn't really matter. Because it's all power behavior. And if you think it does matter, you will put a stress on one of the A's, of which, and that is what you call important. That the stress is the importance. And the stress is the amount of will imported into the situation. Work out the meaning of the letter, repeat the letter, and work out the relation between the same letter, repeated, and so on. Add another letter, play it backwards and forwards, upside down, and so on. Shift a letter. One of the old methods of Kabbalah is to write an alphabet, write the same alphabet, only in a different position, or to turn the alphabet back on itself. This is a very good exercise. I'm doing it quite simply for you. And you see here that you have an exercise chart straight away. Straight away. R, 3. B, bound. But every bound being has R, namely free energy, in it. This bound being is now going to produce an issue. But every issue will become a bound being. So D, there will be a division. But every division itself presupposes a prior issuing power. Now, if you lay your alphabet out in this manner, you'll be doing a series of Kabbalistic tricks which will greatly exercise your mind. Lay the alphabet out in as many ways as you like, spell all the significances to yourself, and then work out the relations between these figures as they arise. You will be exercising your mind, you will be doing mantra yoga at the same time, you will be forming new connections that you couldn't make any other way. Remember that your brain functions intelligently only insofar as it can form logically, that is according to the logos. When you cannot verbally formulate, you cannot control. This may sound awful, but it happens to be a fact. If you don't verbally formulate, you cannot control the elements of your own substance. If you do verbally formulate in various ways, you are actually introducing form into your substance in the process. This form becomes efficiency when you can induce it quickly enough for the given external situation presented.
Just one quick last question. When you get a double L,
yes?
Is there an implication there of two forces working against each other? Four.
Well, let's make a double L and have a look. There's a double L. The meaning of L, as you can see, you make it by wiping your tongue on the palate. There's your palate. Here's your tongue coming up. And it does that. You can see the letter L in it. There it is. In the Hebrew form of it, it goes like that. You can see again that licking, which has been turned on its side and then made a vertical letter. It was made a vertical letter at one point because it got in the way when it was a long letter on the page. And if you look in a 10th century manuscript, you find they got into trouble with it even when it was vertical, because at one time it was very long like that. So you'd have your word down here and then the next word here and this L tearing to the So it was cut down to become more efficient. Now, it means that link, that is joining. The Sanskrit word for a male organ is lingam, which means linkam. It means joining, it means labour, it means all tyings, as in ligature, and so on. So if you get two of them, you must be tying either twice or tying two things. In the case of the word mill, you have a substance, point, that's the same million, million. A mill is a place where you grind whatever there is down, and you grind it so fine that the stuff which started discreetly begins to look like a fluid. It begins to flow. Is liquid. So this tying together of things, this letter L, is signified in a variety of different ways. To join yourselves to something is to labour upon that something. It is to become enlightened about that something according to the amount of energy you put into your labour. So this word light begins with this L for the same reason. Work, labour while it is light. Tie yourself into any situation and you will get illumination, won't you? It may make you sick, in this case it's called illumination. When you are thinking therefore about the meaning of L, add together all these meanings, think of how many ways you can conjoin yourself with yourself and with other beings. They are all signified by L, because the actual function of L is this joining, linking process. But don't let yourself fall into thinking that it is static. Linking, labouring, light and so on are processes. In other words, if you keep at it, you can maintain the link. But even if you made a link, if you don't keep at it, it will be unmade. And because of the nature of power, power is always in motion, and therefore it is either making or breaking a circuit. You never stand still. So if you're not trying to maintain the relationship between yourself and your dear one, well then you're unmaking it, because it cannot stand still. So a relation must either improve or deteriorate from moment to moment. If you know that, of course, you have to wake up, get on your toes, and say, in relation to a given being, am I more or less L? This is said to represent, this must be a Hebrew gem, an ox goad. And the ox is an emasculated bull, and the goad is to see that he gets on with his work. And it's obviously a dirty trick, because if L means link, phonetically, and yet it is said to mean an ox goad, the goad must be a very light one, so the ox doesn't notice. So you could say that a free translation of L means softly, softly catchy monkey. It means that the ox can be goaded best by stroking, really. This, of course, is the essence of the Tao Te Ching. If you meditate on any one letter until you are completely exhausted, when you are, the letter is still not exhausted. And it has relations with other letters as well. When we greet in English, we say hello. And this hell means bright, and this low means behold. So when we say hello to somebody, we are actually wishing them health. Behold, I hope you are in health. Your halo, or power law, I hope you've got it tied up. Work out any given letter as far as you can. When you've worked it out, your mind is ready to receive the next stimulus of that order. If you don't work, your mind is not ready to receive it and cannot receive it. We've done now a certain amount of work on a few letters. To get more information, you must take a given letter, work on it, and then your mind becomes able to receive it. This is very important, because we're always up against this statement. Somebody hears stimulus guns, behold, letters are very valuable things. All right, says he, where's the book that says all the meanings of the letters? This is a universal question. Where is the book that says all the meanings of the letters? The answer is, that book is man. To print such a book would require so many volumes that you haven't got time to read it externally. Furthermore, to get the full value of a letter without endangering yourself, you must work on the letter to the best of your ability. And when you've brought your appreciation of the meaning up to a certain level, then another stimulus can be given safely. But if you get it prematurely, it will disrupt your mind, disorientate you, do you actually no good, and will give you totally false ideas at the level of your awareness. Let's take a little simple fact. Letter T
and the letter O. The letter O and the letter T. Those are two different symbols. You recognize the left one here as the Crux and Sata that you find stamped on Vatican things occasionally. It is borrowed from ancient Egypt, and it signifies T for time and O for eternity. But really, the translation O for eternity is not correct. The O signifies eternal recurrence. It doesn't signify eternity at all. But in all the books, it says, this Crux and Sata means time and eternity. But it doesn't. It means time and eternal recurrence. Or the particular fixed point and the continuance and repetition of that fact. We can say that the top circle means eternity if we think that eternity contains the sum total of all possible recurrences. But if we once say, oh, that means time and eternity, and the mind is unprepared to assimilate it, it just is committed mechanically to memory. The next time a symbol comes up, the head nods. Yes, I know that sign. That means time and eternity. So I don't need to look at it again. The mind is now closed. That's a closed subject. I know that one, so I won't look again. In the same way, this is the sign of the ram. And this one added to it turned it into the sign of the bull. And this added to it turned the whole thing into the sign of Mercury. Well, I know that now. I've said, well, that means Mercury. What is Mercury? Mercury is a planet in the sky. End of story. The mind is now closed. If you don't continuously reopen your mind by further consideration of the meaning of the symbol and the relation of its parts, T-O-C, that's talking, talk eight, incidentally. If you don't continuously reopen it, quite simply, your mind will remain closed. You will have an awareness that you know something, and therefore the subject is no longer a mystery. And because of this, you will feel comfortable, but you will not move. So if you don't work, even on a single letter, to see why an S is written like that. In Greek, there's another one written like that. Now, this one is an initial and medial, and this one is a final. Why is that one initial and medial? Because in the beginning, one ties oneself up, and in the middle, one is tied up. But at the end, one becomes free. See where these forms are, so is to get another idea. But that isn't the end of it. And the mind continuously tends to equilibrate itself. And if it succeeds in equilibrating itself, you're stuck. So if you really want to evolve, the thing to aim at is not an end result called peace of mind. Because that is only a form of substantial equilibrium. It's something totally different. Aim at anything whatever that will give you more than you've already got. In wisdom, in willpower, and so on. Expect no final result, and you won't be disappointed if you don't get one. This is the Taoist statement again. Don't declare your aim and you cannot be said to fail. It is better to travel hopefully than to arrive.